It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
I believe then and now that I am not either of the people in that photo.
He's been completely dishonest and disingenuous. He knew this picture was there and he could have come clean and talked to African Americans that he's close to decades ago.
I believe that I'm in a unique position, obviously, as Lieutenant Governor and someone who would have to assume that office in the event that he were to resign. And so I have to be very circumspect.
He's lost the authority to lead. He's lost the authority to govern. He has to resign.
That is really a fascinating story happening in Northern Virginia. In Virginia, I guess I should say, but Richmond. Maybe I shouldn't say Northern. I guess I think of it as being close to D.C. because that's so much chicanery happens. And, of course, Ralph Northam is just tying himself in a knot trying to get away from the blackface photo that appeared in his yearbook, one guy dressed as a Ku Klux Klan or the other in blackface. And Northam initially said that was him, and he apologized. Now he says he doesn't believe that's him. No, I don't. I changed my mind. The reason we know about the picture is because one of his classmates at medical school actually ratted on it because he was so upset about Northam's comments about letting a baby be born and then making it comfortable while they decide, you know, whether to kill it or not. Basically, that's what he said on a live radio interview. And so the outrage has been palpable. You have to know that Ralph Northam received $2 million in donations from Planned Parenthood. But then you have, on the other hand, the Lieutenant Governor Fairfax, who is Planned Parenthood board member, who is arguably worse than Northam on the issue of life. Doug McElway has a report on what's unfolding there, and we should hear it. It's just amazing. Let's listen.
Shut it down!
The man who would take Governor Ralph Northam's place, Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax, is also embroiled in controversy. In a private message to a friend, a Stanford University fellow alleges she was sexually assaulted at the 2004 Democratic National Convention by an office holder about to get a very big promotion. She mentioned no name, but today Fairfax acknowledged she was accusing him. He maintains it was consensual.
The allegation is completely false. In fact, this person, a year ago, came to the Washington Post with this very same allegation. They investigated it for several months, and then they made the decision not to publish the story because it was not credible.
Today, the Post disputed Fairfax's characterization that there were inconsistencies with the allegations. Fairfax was asked if he thought Governor Northam was behind the new allegation.
Does anybody think it's any coincidence that on the eve of potentially my being elevated, that that's when this uncorroborated smear comes out?
Yeah, so that's the first part of Doug McElway's report on Fox. Now, here's the thing, Justin Fairfax, did you hear what he just said? He's actually acquiescing to the notion that his partner, his governor, he's lieutenant governor, was the one who leaked the information on him to the press. Now, we don't know if that's true or not. He says it's because, you know, he's the likely successor, so he thinks Northam's trying to come after him. Meanwhile, the Washington Post failed to print a report about Justin Fairfax when he was running for office about his alleged, I guess you would call it an assault. It's pretty graphic. They refused to report it during the election cycle. And so then Justin Fairfax is claiming that it wasn't true. That's why they didn't report it. And then the Washington Post printed all the details, I think yesterday or the day before, saying, it wasn't that we didn't think it was credible. And so do you see the twists and turns? It's funny. It just seems as though the left is getting caught in its own web. I mean, they have destroyed so many people by inference and just by throwing out the name racist or whatever they're throwing out, and now and chauvinist and the Me Too movement. They've marched on it. They've loved it because it's destroyed a lot of people that they don't like, and so now they're getting caught up in that web. And I think it's pretty fascinating. There's a lot to say about this, but there are some points I want to make. First of all, I ask you, those of you listening who live in that area and others, to go to that pro-life rally at the delegate trans town hall meeting. She had scheduled a town hall in Fairfax, and would you believe, sometimes you just never know what the upshot of these things are because the national news doesn't print it. But there were somewhere between 750 and 800, who knows, how many protesters showed up at that town hall. And Kathy Tran, who was going to hold the town hall, she's the one who announced her intention to do away with all abortion restrictions in Virginia and was happy to say that you could even abort your baby on the day of birth. Your baby could be killed after it was born. It was amazing, her dispassionate statement in Richmond on the floor there in the House of Delegates. And so she was going to be holding this town hall, and lots of protesters came. And what happened? She canceled her town hall meeting. So for those of you who made that journey, made that attempt, I just wanted you to know that you had great effect. That does not mean this situation is settled. It means that you found time in your lives to take a stand. And God bless you for doing that. And let me just say that there is a March for Life in Richmond. It's going to be day after tomorrow, February the 7th, Commonwealth for Life. Commonwealth, that's what they call the state of Virginia. It's a Commonwealth. Commonwealth for Life, it's a march on Richmond, and it is at 10 o'clock in the morning at Virginia State Capitol. So those of you listening, if you want to do something, and I know many of you do, you want to do something, you cannot believe the things that are being discussed in the public arena as though it's nothing. And you see the gloating of these pro-choice advocates. I didn't even get a chance to play the entire press conference yesterday for you. Of these Governor Northam, Fairfax, Kathy Tran, their statements gloating about what they plan to do, that they have this particular bill didn't make it, but they're coming back with a vengeance, and they're working on pro-choice, pro-death, let's just say, candidates, and they're going to fill the House of Delegates, and they're going to have their way, and they're really can't wait. It's exciting. And so meanwhile, on the federal level, Ben Sasse has offered some legislation to save babies in that final stage, the final trimester. And, of course, Patty Murray, the Democrat from Washington State, has blocked it. So it's not going to be coming up for a vote. Why would she do that? Mitch McConnell refers back to reminiscent, he says, Ben Sasse's bill is reminiscent of the Born Alive Infant Protection Act of 2002. Do you remember that? You know, this brought back a flood of memories that I just have to share. I just have to. I thought as I was reading that, just before I went on the air, I thought, oh my goodness, some things just come around full circle. Do you know who's responsible for the necessity of a Born Alive Protection Act? Do you know where that started? The whole practice was letting babies be born, and if they survived an abortion or they were unwanted, they would put them in a room in a hospital and just let them die. And then they would just end up in the trash can. And if you wonder where that's, let me do this backwards. This happened in Illinois, and the senator who was gung-ho to let these babies die was Barack Obama. And the story of what was happening actually broke on a local Chicago radio program. It was the Sandy Rios program. And it happened because a pastor called me offline to tell me that someone in his congregation, a nurse who was working at this hospital, had witnessed this firsthand. And she was so upset, and she didn't know what to do because it was her job and because she feared for her job and she feared to speak up. And so together with him, we persuaded her to go public on my show for the first time. Her name was Jill Stanek. Many of you have heard her name since then. Jill came on and very haltingly, with some fear, talked about what was happening in this hospital on the south side of Chicago. She described it in great detail, and of course she went on to be a real champion on this issue because she became fearless. Thank God for Jill Stanek. But that started on my radio show, and after that, Barack Obama, he loved it. He loved the fact that this was allowed to happen, and he fought it tooth and nail, this Born Alive Infant Protection Act that passed in Illinois. And then, of course, it found its way up to the federal level and passed in 2002. So I just wanted to give you some background on that. It's just as interesting, isn't it? It's interesting to me. I can't even find the words to how that makes me feel. Not good, because how horrible. But satisfied in some ways that there was some contribution to stopping it. You know, on this, I'm going to spend all of my time talking about this, and I really want to talk about other things. So I'm going to change the subject. Tonight is the State of the Union address, and the theme is choosing greatness, and I think he's going to be challenging the Democrats to work with him to make this country great. He's going to talk about his successes. He's going to talk about the border. I don't think that he will announce that he's going to do an executive order on building a wall or declare an emergency. I don't think he'll do that yet. I think he'll let the thing run its course in Congress. So I'm just saying. And there will be lots of interesting guests with the president. Two of them have been highlighted here. Timothy Mattson was part of the SWAT team in Pittsburgh that went to the Tree of Life Synagogue. Timothy was shot, multiple gunshot wounds, but he saved countless lives, and he'll be there. And Judah Samet will be there. He is a member of the Tree of Life Synagogue. He's also a survivor of the Holocaust. Isn't that something? Judah immigrated to Israel after the war and was present for the declaration of the Israeli state in 1948. And so that's just two guests of the president. Of course, the Democrats will bring their own. And I'll let that play out for you, the circus that will ensue. I'm sure the Democrats will be very disrespectful. Why wouldn't they be? It's their custom. I expect it to be sort of like the Kavanaugh hearings. I think you'll hear screeching and calling out. I mean, the lady that screamed at Jeff Flake in the elevator during the Kavanaugh hearings is going to be one of the guests. So I wonder if she's got some screaming left in her. I don't know. But we'll see if the Capitol Police actually puts a lid on it. I hope they do, but I don't have confidence that they will. I have several other things I want to mention to you on the Super Bowl. It's interesting. I just learned today that there was a company, a clothing apparel company, owned by a veteran, and they offered a commercial for the Super Bowl, which was patriotic, was pro-flag. It contained footage of American soldiers, military equipment, first responders, the graves of fallen soldiers, narrated by a former U.S. Marine who was a survivor of Benghazi. And guess what? CBS rejected it. And so it's called Nine Line Apparel, Nine Line Apparel. So Nine Line Apparel is speaking out, and they're accusing CBS of, you know what, they're accusing them of content control. And CBS's response is, well, we didn't think they could afford the commercial, like it's their business. They did $25 million in business last year, so I guess if they thought they could afford that ad, they must have known that. But CBS decided to help them out and not let them run the ad. Also, Catherine Herridge mentioned last night, but I'll have to do it briefly. It looks as though we have documentation now to show that CNN was, in fact, tipped off about the arrest of Roger Stone. The details, if I can find the words quickly, are that a document that was part of the, what do we call this? The indictment was, it looks as though, leaked to CNN as we had thought. Interestingly enough, it has initials on it that look to be, we think, Andrew Weissman's. He's the lead investigator on the Mueller team. We don't know that those initials, although they look like his initials, they are initials that correspond with his initials. We don't know that means Andrew Weissman leaked it to CNN, but we do know CNN was there an hour before the FBI even showed up. It was a CNN reporter who alerted Roger Stone's attorney that Roger Stone was being arrested at that time at 6 o'clock in the morning. It really is an amazing story. And so Roger Stone's attorneys are asking members of the Senate and the House to investigate what in the world's going on here. What happened? Somebody needs to find out. And speaking of nefarious things that we need to find out about, you've got to stay tuned because Luke Rosiak is joining us next. His latest book on the scandal, the IT scandal in the House. You have to hear it. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
When an abortion-minded woman walks into a preborn pregnancy center, she encounters love and compassion and gets to meet her baby by ultrasound.
And I was like, I'm going to go to the abortion clinic. And I already had my mind made up.
This mom didn't make it to the abortion clinic. Instead, God led her to a preborn center.
And the lady is giving me my ultrasound. She's like making these weird faces, and then she's like, it's two. And I'm like, I just start crying. I start texting my friends, and like, I can't.
The Ministry of Preborn was able to help this mom save not just one life, but two through ultrasounds. Preborn centers help save babies' lives and souls. Preborn runs and leads Christian pregnancy centers all over the country. To find out more, go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com. Or dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 and say baby. Your love can save a life.
I'm Peter Rosenberger, and this is your Caregiver Minute. One of the toughest challenges for caregivers is to detach from the poor conduct of our loved one. Chronic pain, dementia, pharmaceuticals, fear, those things can cause all types of behavior issues. Maybe they're just having a bad day. Regardless of what's going on with them, we don't have to take it personally, even if it sounds personal. As long as our self-worth is tied to the opinion of someone else, we're never going to be a healthy person. You are an extraordinary individual created in the image of God, and amazingly, you show up to care for an impaired loved one. They may pop off at you, say hurtful things, and berate you, but remember, they are impaired on some level. Why would you attach your value to a sickness? Listen, they're not doing it to you, they're just doing it. Let it go on past you and go about your day feeling confident you're doing the best you can with what you have and what you know.
This has been your Caregiver Minute with Peter Rosenberger, brought to you by Standing with Hope, a ministry for the wounded and those who care for them. There's more information at standingwithhope.com.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next.
Truett McConnell University.
So my name is Atara. I'm a senior and my major is psychology. I love Truett. There may be a lot of other schools out there. You can go to bigger schools. You can go to schools that's way far away from home. But in the end, one of the things that I realized is that God called me here, and that's why Truett is the perfect place for me. And if God called you here, then it's the perfect place for you also.
Are you called? Visit truett.edu today.
Virginia Governor Ralph Northam learned a very important lesson the other day. The Democrats will forgive a lawmaker who supports abortions on delivery day, but they will not forgive racism. The great irony is that Governor Northam spent the entirety of his adult life promoting race relations, only to be done in because of his behavior as a 25-year-old. There is no excuse for dressing in blackface or a Klan uniform, but is the Ralph Northam of today the same guy he was 35 years ago? So what's the lesson here? Parents, you need to actively police what your kids are doing online and the kinds of music they listen to. Their choices today could haunt them for the rest of their lives. Just think about that for a moment. Somewhere in America right now, a white teenager is singing along to racially charged hip-hop music, completely unaware he may have just ruined the rest of his life. I'm Todd Starnes.
Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I'd like to know how Capitol Police handle equipment that belongs to a member or a staffer that's been lost within the Capitol complex and found or recovered by one of your officers. What happens?
Sure. Well, it's processed on what's called a PD-81, which is a property record. And depending on the property, depending on how it's, if you can legitimately determine ownership, then it's generally turned back over to the owner of the property. If it's part of an ongoing case, then there are other things that have to occur for that to happen.
So if a member says that they have equipment that's been lost and you find it, it would be returned to the member?
In a general sense, yes.
If the equipment belongs to the member, it has been lost, they say it's been lost and it's been identified as that member's, and the Capitol Police is supposed to return it, correct?
Well, it's not a. I can't give a yes or no answer on that because I know
it's a simple yes or no answer. Well, if a member loses the equipment,
yes, ma'am,
and it is found by the Capitol Police or your staff, and it is identified as that member's equipment, and the member is not associated with any case, and that is their equipment, it is supposed to be returned. Yes or no?
Depends on the circumstances, and if the circumstances.
I don't understand how that's possible. Members' equipment is members' equipment. It is not Under my understanding, the Capitol Police is not able to confiscate members' equipment when the member is not under investigation. It is their equipment, and it's supposed to be returned.
Well, I think there's extenuating circumstances in this case, and I think that, you know, working through my counsel and the necessary personnel, if that in fact is the case, and with the permission of through the investigation, then we'll return the equipment. But until that's accomplished, I can't return the equipment.
I think you're violating the rules when you conduct your business that way, and should expect that there would be consequences.
Well, I have to say that I think was the first exchange that came to my attention that made me wonder what in the world is going on. That's Debbie Wasserman Schultz. She was the head of the DNC, a powerful member of Congress. She's grilling the head of the Capitol Police about a laptop. And at the end of that exchange, she's threatening him because he won't turn over her laptop. Why in the world would that be the case? That was like the tip of the iceberg. And there was a young reporter from the Daily Caller who took this thing on and latched onto it and, like a bulldog, got to the bottom of what this story was all about. And it became a huge story, I have to say, not nationally, not really, except for James Rosen and a few Fox reporters. You probably don't even remember this unless you remember me talking to Luke a few months ago when he was working on this book. But it has developed into probably, among all the scandals that took place in 2016 and 2017, this may be the most impactful, the most dangerous hoax and scandal perpetrated on the American people. Luke Rosiak is an investigative reporter for the Daily Caller News Foundation. He worked in the for Homeland Security as a reporter and investigator before that. And he does an excellent job of reporting, unlike so many reporters now that, you know, we read their Twitter feed and just repeat what their other reporters are finding online. Luke is a boots-on-the-ground reporter, and he has gotten to the bottom of this huge scandal. Luke, thanks for joining us this morning.
Great to be here.
I did not say, and I want to, that his new book, which chronicles all of this, is called Obstruction of Justice: How the Deep State Risk National Security to Protect the Democrats. Luke, just a general question first. Do you actually think that this scandal is maybe the most egregious scandal of 2016?
I do. I think it's the most fascinating. It's just like something out of a movie. And it was really had the ability to change the 2016 election and the same way that they kind of constructed this whole Russia narrative using Fusion GPS and paying these Oppo research firms, paying the dossier, and sending it into the FBI, they manipulated us to conceal this absolutely astonishing thing that happened, this truly frightening thing. And so what happened itself is frightening with this Pakistani guy that hacked Congress. The other thing that's frightening, Sandy, is just the ability that how easily we are manipulated by these people, how easily they conceal things from us.
Big things, major things. It's like, I always use, this is kind of a dumbed down example, Luke, but I always say to my listeners, now, you look at Melania Trump, and I'm just thinking, you know, she's gorgeous, and she wears beautiful clothes, but the press tells us, oh no, not so much. She's the magazines refuse to put her on the covers, and then they tell us her fashion sense is so terrible, her sense of decorating. My point is, this is obviously false. We can see this with our own eyes, and yet people are persuaded by the print, by major media, that Melania is not all that pretty, has a terrible fashion sense, and can't decorate the White House. That's a small thing, but it's an example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's reporting this story about the hackers is really the real collusion, the real foreign meddling, the real hacking. And then to see how they talk about Russia all the time, where somehow Trump colluded with who, I don't know what. I mean, no one can even say what this collusion is, but we have to hear about it all the time. And meanwhile, you heard the clip. This is a guy with Debbie Wasserman Schultz who was caught hacking the Congress. And after he was caught, he went in and he stole her laptop and left it in the phone booth at midnight. And then Wasserman Schultz is threatening the Capitol Police to obstruct the investigation. And I had been warning people for months before that. I said, this guy was secretly caught hacking Congress. He's trying to flee to Pakistan. He's got connections to foreign governments. He's laundering money. And you never really heard about it anywhere else. And no one really believed me. And then this laptop pops up. And I said, that's exactly what I told you was happening. And so in this book, I've got documents, I've got records, I've got first-hand interviews. And it kind of lays out what happened. And then the FBI is like, oh, don't worry. There's nothing to see here. But they never... you know, the media gobbles it up, and they're like, oh, well, it must be a conspiracy theory. But the FBI never explained how none of this was real, and the book really lays out extremely compellingly, I think. And then the book goes into how exactly the Democrats manipulated the investigation to make this go away. And, I mean, it's just like you heard on the clip with Wasserman Schultz, but there's a lot more to it. And so when the Democrats tell you or your liberal friends say, oh, that's debunked, that's nothing there, it didn't just happen to become that way. It didn't just happen to be that the FBI, you know, made this go away. The Democrats are very, very savvy. They know how to work the media. They know how to work the bureaucrats much better than the Republicans do, and they try really hard to do just that. So we had witnesses threatened, investigators retaliated against, evidence disappearing. And my book kind of walks you through sort of the anatomy of the deep state. And it's just like, you know, it took us 2 years to learn what we do hear about in the media about how Fusion GPS, they're manipulating this and that, and this dossier. The Russia investigation didn't just happen. It was artificially, you know, orchestrated. And so this is kind of the inverse of that. And it really takes you, it's a fun book to read because it's like you're watching a movie. It's just, it's drama from start to end. But kind of the takeaway of it is, this is how they're manipulating us. This is how they construct what we believe to be true. And this is how the Democrats basically have this alliance between the mainstream media and the Department of Justice, where, you know, we've got two tiers of justice. Some of us will, you know, have to abide by the rules and the laws, and others don't. And we also have, you know, two separate realities, the one that actually occurred and then the one that the Democrats and the media tell us is, you know, what's actually going on.
Look, I want to repeat what you just said in a different way. What you're saying is the whole Russian narrative is a lie. It is fabricated. All the connections and this alleged collusion with a foreign government to undermine the elections. And so they've made the American people believe that lie. At least a ton of them do. On the inverse, this scandal, which we haven't even talked about what it is, this scandal is deeply dangerous, horrible for implications for national security and for all of it, and yet the inverse applies where they made it sound as though it can't be true, they didn't, and the investigations were blocked, and the American people really, I think, successfully were shielded from the story. Look, the only reason, besides your writing about it, the only reason that I was keen to it is because I know a lot of people on Capitol Hill who privately talked about their fear that everything on everyone's computer had been hacked and could be leaked and could be even intelligence things could be given to foreign powers. So let's get into the details of this. I know this is old hat for you, but this is the part of it. You have to repeat it. There are two Pakistani nationals, they're brothers, and they're not even vetted, and somehow they get into the house as the IT persons for Debbie Wasserman Schultz and what, one in four Democrats? Is that right? Serving in Congress?
Yeah, they were working, you know, part-time for 40 different members of Congress. So they had all the files and emails of 20% of Congress. And they had these positions for many years as the systems administrators managing the servers. And it turns out that, you know, they didn't really have any training, they didn't have any background, they had, you know, criminal record, they had $1 million bankruptcy while they were working for the House, all the suspicious stuff. The Democrats, not only did they hire foreign nationals and give them the keys to their server, they exempted them from background checks even though they were required, and so this goes on and on for many years, until during the 2016 election, an investigator, the House Inspector General, found that they were hacking Congress, and they were funneling data off the network. They were violating just about every single rule in the House. They were logging in as members of Congress. A couple of these members had fired them over the years. Well, guess what? These guys kept logging in after they were fired, like they were retaliating against the members. And so, you know, this they catch them actually the same week as the DNC thing happened. And so that was when the Democrats decided, we're going to do this Russia PR push. It's going to be the way that we, you know, tie Trump to Russia and we try to make sure that Hillary wins. And so when they were confronted with an actual hack by foreign nationals, they covered it up and they let them stay on the House network because there was just no way to arrest them without it hitting the media, and then the Russia narrative becomes a lot more complicated. And so the United States Congress was being hacked by these guys continuously throughout the entire election season, and the Democrats knew it. And so they waited until right after the election in order to finally kick them off the network. But even then, they still didn't arrest them. And that's when you started to see this obstruction of justice, this evidence disappearing. And so there's the Capitol Police memo. So, for example, the Inspector General said that one of the main servers they were hacking was the House Democratic Caucus. So that's a group that's actually very similar to the DNC inside the House of Representatives. This server was key because it had all this evidence of hacking. Well, the Capitol Police finally go to bust these guys, and they write a memo that says, holy cow, the server disappeared. The House Democratic Caucus server has gone missing. And so all this time we're hearing about, you know, Russia hacking, blah, 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 DNC. No one was going to tell us, Sandy, the freaking House Democratic Caucus server went missing while it was, you know, the hacking, while it was tied to this hacking suspect. And then the laptop thing we already talked about, evidence starts disappearing. So I find out who these guys are because no one else really was told about it. And I look into their background, and everything about these guys, it has the mark of extortionists and, you know, like really potentially foreign agents. I mean, this is a guy. So I find that this guy, and I go down to the local courthouse and I find records. In other words, it's not that hard. He's taking $100,000 from an Iranian government minister who's been tied to Hezbollah while he's working for members of the Intelligence Committee. And the list goes on and on. I mean, he's sending equipment over to Pakistan. He's banned from the network. The laptop thing happens. I find out he's also got a hidden back door into the Congress because he's stolen the identity of an intelligence staffer, actually one who works for Andre Carson, who's a Muslim member of Congress on the Intelligence Committee. And so he's got this secret email address called 123@mail.house.gov that he can log in even after he's caught. So this has all the markings of just a horrible, horrible predator from Pakistan who's infiltrated the Congress, who's caught, evidence starts disappearing, and then the Democrats get involved, and they kind of join on the pile. And the inspector general who caught it, she's driven out of Congress. So investigators are retaliated against. Witnesses are threatened. It's truly like out of James Bond.
So in your research on this, Luke, do you think, all right, are these guys, from your perspective, just crooks, extortionists trying to make a lot of money, or do you think that they really are potentially spies for a foreign government like Iran?
I think it's both. I think that this guy is motivated by money. I did a lot of research into his background for the book, and kind of everyone, his own family members say, you know, he would sell his own mom for a penny, and there's really a lot of depraved examples of the kind of thing, the kind of examples where this guy does not let an opportunity for a buck, you know, slip by. But you have to remember that when he had his whole family working for Congress. He had seven of his immediate family all born in Pakistan. With all the passwords to all the servers of Congress, you know, you have to imagine that then Pakistani intelligence would approach him, because Pakistan has a very good intelligence service. They approach him, and if they did, he's not going to say no. And so you put that together with all the evidence that I uncovered. He travels Pakistan with an entourage of, first of all, this guy spends about 3 months out of the year in Pakistan every year, and they still pay him. He doesn't take vacation. He's still logging into Congress from Pakistan.
Wow.
Luke, don't care.
Luke, hold that thought. Hold that thought, because the music's playing. I got to take a break. But this is Luke Oroziak, and his new book is called Obstruction of Justice: How the Deep State Risks National Security to Protect the Democrats. Newt Gingrich wrote the foreword. He has some great endorsements here: Peter Schweitzer, Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, Dana Loesch. But the point is that Luke is actually the one who discovered all these things. He's not just reading other people's writings about this. Luke was the guy, and he writes this. This is a great book. You'll want to get this. Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk.
Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. California State Senate Judiciary Committee Chairwoman Hannah Beth Jackson announced her committee was adopting a new rule banning the use of the traditional binary pronouns he, she, her, or him in hearings. She went on to say, "We're using what my grammar teacher would have had a heart attack over. We're using the phrase they. My grammar teacher's long gone, and I won't be hearing from her." After announcing it, the chairwoman violated her own rule. The irony would be funny, but it shows government won't be content until it controls what we think and say.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Have you been looking for a way to serve others? Are you able to serve in a ministry without being paid? You and Friendships might be the perfect match. Friendships is currently taking applications for volunteers providing aid to disaster victims, refugees, and the impoverished, both here at home and around the world. Get more information at friendships.org or by calling 337-433-5022.
Jesus said, "Let me tell you how to deal with that. I'll just give you one simple prayer that'll take care of all of that stress in your life. Here it is. You ready for it? Teach me to do thy will, O God."
Join Dr. David Jeremiah for his important series, Christians Have Stress Too, next time on Turning Point.
5:30 a.m. and 7 p.m. Central on American Family Radio.
Brian Fisher here with today's Life and Liberty Minute. In Donald Trump's Super Bowl interview, he said it's time to get America out of endless wars around the globe. He's right. According to the Smithsonian, our military is now deployed in 80 countries, if you can believe it, in 40% of the world. We have no fewer than 800 military bases around the world. Since 2001, we have spent $5.9 trillion on six continents. Right now, we have 138,000 troops stationed abroad in places like Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Pakistan, all hotbeds of Muslim extremism. The president is right that it is time to bring most of our troops home, especially from Syria and Afghanistan. The president does not want to see any more American blood spilled in the wastelands of Syria and Afghanistan, and I don't either.
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Tonight, President Trump will report on the State of Our Union. Much of the rhetoric will be familiar. A list of accomplishments, descriptions of challenges facing the Republic, calls for unit, etc. The imagery is often as important as the content of the message, however. Political rivals come together to honor the presidency, despite sharp disagreements with its incumbent, creating a welcome impression of a robust union. Last year, though, when Representative Nancy Pelosi was the House Minority Leader, she led her Democratic caucus in repeated symbolic repudiations of the president's remarks as cameras captured their angry looks and refusals to applaud. Tonight, House Speaker Pelosi will be on camera throughout, seated on the dais behind President Trump next to Vice President Mike Pence. How she conducts herself will do much to shape public perceptions of the state of the union. This is Frank Gaffney.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
You know, just a word about the State of the Union address. I have to say that after all is said and done, I'm really actually glad that the president is able to deliver this speech in the House per usual. With all of its pomp and circumstance, I'm happy for that. I'm happy that he has this platform. And so I'll be looking forward to it. And of course, we'll be watching it tonight. We'll be playing some of it tomorrow and opening the phone line. So make sure you watch it so we can discuss it. And it will be interesting to watch Nancy Pelosi sitting behind him during the entire thing, don't you think? It's a drama playing out before our eyes, and a drama with very serious repercussions. Let me mention that we are working with India Partners as you well know, to get little kids as young as 8 years old, boys and girls, out of trafficking in Mumbai, India. Many of them are in the red light area. Some of them are the children of the prostitutes. Some of them become mothers themselves at very early ages. And so India Partners operates these safe houses away from the red light district. And what we try to do with India Partners is provide the resources so they can get the kids out and take them to these safe houses. And amazingly, it only costs $7.08 a day for one day for one child. I just think that's an amazing amount of money. And of course, it's room and board, it's a place to sleep, it's food, it's a full-time Christian school. Yes, they will be taught about Jesus. They will be taught that there is a Savior, that there is a more excellent way, as Theophilus, as Paul said to Theophilus, there's a better way, and they'll be told about that. And so if you'd like to be part of this, every day our goal is to provide 1,000 days for these children, 1,000 days. So we're just starting out. I'm the first live show of the morning. And so if you would like to make a donation, just figure out how many sevens you can afford. It's 877-616-2396. That's 877-616-2396, or go to AFR.net, AFR.net. Boy, it's nice to do something good, isn't it? When you think about all of the bad things that are happening, the really wicked things. And that's what Luke Rosiak has chronicled, just one of the many, maybe one of the worst, that came out in the last few years, the scandals that are being played out to destroy, really, this republic. The book is called Obstruction of Justice, How the Deep State Risk National Security to Protect the Democrats. And Luke is telling us the story that he researched for 2 years. He was the guy on this story. And it was these Pakistani brothers who were not vetted, who came into the House of Representatives, ended up doing the IT and having all the access to the intelligence committees. Some say, and I'll ask Luke in just a second, that even the Republicans feared that these Pakistani brothers had access to all their information. Luke also just told us that an Iranian foreign minister was paying one of them, among others. And we know that the Pakistani intelligence services are very powerful and certainly not out for our best interests. And we don't know about the official link between that, but it's just an obvious concern. And so, Luke, before we took a break, you were telling us how they were able to access things even from Pakistan, while the Democratic leadership just turned a blind eye to that.
Yeah, so I first wrote this I named these guys way back when Trump was first inaugurated, and I got a call from a Pakistani woman who was, it turned out, this guy, the hacker, his stepmom. And so she said, I've been held in captivity for the last few months by this guy. He's a blackmailer. He surveilled me. He used his IT skills to bug my house. And he said if I told anyone, he would have my whole family killed in Pakistan. And so I said, I mean, my jaw just hit the floor. And so I looked into it further, and everywhere I looked was confirmation and was similar stories. And so you Google this guy's name, and way back in 2009, there's a newspaper article in Pakistan that wrote about him, saying that he was a powerful White House official, and he got into some trouble there, and he basically extorted all the witnesses, framed the victims, called his buddies at the Pakistani government through some inordinate political power he had, and had the victims all thrown in jail. And so he was able to basically commit all these crimes with impunity in Pakistan. So it goes on like this, and there's a guy in the newspaper article that's named as his business partner. So I call that guy up, and he says, oh, yeah, Imran Awan, he gave a USB of data to the interior minister here in Pakistan. And after that, he traveled and he received protection from a motorcade of armed Pakistani agents at all times when he was in Pakistan. So I said, I don't really have any way to confirm whether or not he handed off the USB. So I called the FBI, actually, at that point, because as a reporter, I felt like someone else needed to know about this. FBI refuses to talk to this witness who's like his business partner, and he's saying this on the record. The FBI doesn't want to know. But he's saying, okay, well, as a result of the USB, he travels with all this protection from Pakistani agents. And I did confirm that. I actually had a freelancer go to Pakistan, and everyone in the village where he lives saw it. So it's like, here's this guy. He's supposed to just be like plugging in the mouse and keyboard for Debbie Wasserman Schultz. He's like a low-level guy here in America. How all this stuff is going on, all of it is documented, all of it is verifiable. how is this normal? What's the explanation for it all?
So the FBI did nothing. Did you try again? Did you try ever again, Luke? Or to your knowledge, did they do anything to follow up on an investigation for these guys?
So one of the revelations in the book, Sandy, is that this guy's own wife, the suspect, Imran Awan, his own wife, came forward at the end and said, he told me he's a mole in Congress. That was the word that he used to her. He's a mole in Congress. He knows too much about congressmen that I can never be in trouble because of how much he knows from all their data. The wife said, look, I'm going to go to the FBI and I'm going to tell him that because the United States is my adopted country and I feel loyalty to it. And he said, you know, well, guess what? I've got hidden cameras all around our house. I've got a video of us having sex. I'm going to post that sex tape over in Pakistan. You're going to be disowned. You're going to be, cast out of society there. And so he starts blackmailing her. And so this is a guy that, the case has all the overtones of blackmail and extortion on Capitol Hill, and he's trying to get away with it by blackmailing a witness. And so it goes on like this, and I'm dealing with the wife. And finally the wife says, screw it. I'm going to go to the FBI. I don't care what he does to me. It's the right thing to do. And so the FBI actually starts harassing the wife instead. So the FBI turns against this witness, and actually on the day the FBI refuses to talk to anyone else, someone actually finds smashed hard drives tied to this guy. The FBI loses them. The FBI accidentally gives other evidence over to his defense attorney when it was supposed to go to prosecutors. And so this goes on and on, and eventually the prosecutors had this hearing where they're going to say this guy did nothing wrong, and they put out a statement actually like defending him, which is completely bizarre. They would never do that for any other suspect who didn't wind up being charged. So the FBI goes to his wife's house and stands out front of the door to make sure she can't go to the court hearing and tell the judge what she had already told the FBI, which is that this guy allegedly shot at her and was threatening her, that he was blackmailing her with a sex tape, and that he admitted to using his job as an IT guy for Debbie Wasserman Schultz to become a mole in Congress.
Wow, Luke, that's breathtaking, honestly. And let me just say, that's James Comey's FBI. It was James Comey's
FBI.
Yeah,
correct. And, we name all the FBI agents from top to low, and this is kind of like, you want to know how the FBI works, this book, Obstruction of Justice, kind of lays it out for you.
Yeah, worked under James Comey and under Bob Mueller before him. Let me just say, I want to repeat something you said because I'm shocked by this, and I just want to mark it as something I want people to remember. The first Muslim congressman was Andre Carson. There now he has a couple of other friends. He's from Indiana. And you said that Imran Awan stole the identity of Andre Carson's intelligence aide or whatever his title was, and that's how he continued to log in on the computers. Well, he maybe stole it, and my suspicions are there might have been some arrangement given the politics going on here, but I don't know that. But let me ask you some big things. This all broke, as you said, on the heels of the Hillary Clinton email server and the leaking of the emails from John Podesta and the DNC, which the Democrats quickly said was all Russia's fault. I heard, I know you have, of course you have, you certainly, surely must have looked into whether these guys might actually have been the leakers in that story. Is that possible?
It's definitely possible. And when you read the book, it's really just such a, I think anyone who reads it will be convinced that they hacked Congress in a horrible way and that anything that they had access to, they would do something horrible with. And sure enough, they did have access to the DNC emails. In fact, if you Google the name Imran, because we're talking about the guy Imran Awan here, if you Google his name in WikiLeaks, you search his name in WikiLeaks, it pops up as being the only one who had access to Debbie Wasserman Schultz's password. And so actually the DNC staff itself, this is the guy they had to call up when they wanted to unlock her devices. So, he absolutely had access to that data, and I think when he got caught hacking Congress the exact same week as the DNC got hacked, it was two things. I mean, is it possible that he actually did it? And number two, even if he didn't, the perception is certainly going to be that he did. Everyone's going to be asking these questions because, like you said, it was 10 minutes after the company, of course, Wasserman Schultz refused to let the FBI see the DNC servers. They hired a private company called CrowdStrike, And CrowdStrike said, oh, within 10 minutes, we knew it was Russia. Well, they didn't. The authorities hadn't seen any evidence of that. No Russians had been arrested. Meanwhile, this Pakistani guy on Capitol Hill who worked for Debbie Wasserman Schultz had been caught. He had a name, he had a face, and so for the sake of the narrative, if not the reality of it, I think they had to make sure that this didn't come about, because number one, hacking Congress is worse than hacking the DNC. The DNC is just a fundraising group. If Debbie Wasserman Schultz hadn't rigged the election against Bernie Sanders, hacking the DNC wouldn't have actually been that bad. Meanwhile, Congress is an actual government group, actual government servers. This was the Democrats controlling the narrative. They're PR masters. They knew that this second hack possibly related to the first, but my book kind of just focuses on what happened in Congress. For the sake of the narrative, the American people couldn't be allowed to know about this, and not only were we not allowed to know about it, the national security threat had to be allowed to go free, so that the Washington Post could say, hey, it's all a conspiracy theory. But when you read this book, I mean, I don't think anyone could come to the conclusion that, any other conclusion, but, you know, it's the Washington Post that is the conspiracy theorist, and the FBI, they're just kind of bootlickers for the FBI. They're saying, oh, the FBI said he didn't do anything wrong. Well, look at the evidence, look at what the FBI said, and I think, you know, it's really going to shake your faith in the American justice system.
You know, Luke, the obvious elephant in the room, too, and this is something else I heard discussed behind closed doors. What was wrong with Paul Ryan and the Republican leadership that they actually cooperated in keeping this quiet? What was wrong with them? What was that all about?
It really did, and that's one of the a lot of the book is sort of this cat and mouse game between staff who are Democratic staff working for Nancy Pelosi and Republican staff working for Paul Ryan. And you see from the first few pages that the Democrats are lying. They're tricksters. And they want to pretend, hey, we never really heard about this Pakistani thing. It must be a conspiracy theory from the Daily Caller. Like, from the very beginning, the Democrats were frantically, frantically lying, concealing, retaliating. They were working at full speed to make this go away. And the Republicans were outnumbered. They were outmaneuvered. They were out, the Democrats wanted it more. And the Republicans tended to be sort of this meek type of person that was like, well, we don't want any drama. They were very susceptible for all the lies. They kept falling for it. It's a sad story. It's scary. But when you read it, you can't help but laugh. These buffoons on Capitol Hill, the Republicans, how easy it is to manipulate them. And so, and one of the things that they did eventually is they said, well, basically, so this goes through a lot of fraud on Capitol Hill, a lot of rule breaking that was exposed by this. And so the Democrats go, it really is bad. It's horrible. And guess what? Who's in charge? It's Paul Ryan's in charge. Why didn't you stop it, Paul Ryan? And so they put the Republicans on the defensive, and the Republicans are kind of dumb enough to fall for that. And they say, oh, geez, we better cover this up. We don't want anyone to see how incompetent we were in administering the House and enforcing the rules.
Well, let me just say, Luke, thank you for your courage. I wanted to ask you quickly, 15 seconds, has there been any repercussion to you personally? Have you felt in danger at all for your research?
No, but, you know, sources have, witnesses have. Luckily, not myself yet.
All right. The book is called Obstruction of Justice, How the Deep State Risk National Security to Protect Democrats. And if you want a good novel, only this is true, you'll want to pick this book up. Again, Obstruction of Justice, Luke Rosiak, the courageous reporter, bringing this all to us. And he writes, by the way, all the time for the Daily Caller, which is becoming the source for information in Washington, D.C. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.